After this brief glimpse, the light of history upon this region fades again, and when it becomes bright once more, it's on the eastern and not upon the western side. Far away to the east, Shi Huang Ti had routed the Huns and walled them out of China proper. A portion of these people remained in the north of China, a remnant which was destined to amalgamate with Chinese life under the Huns, but a considerable section had turned westward, and 2nd and 1st centuries B.C. driven before them a kindred people called the Huai Chi, driving them from the eastern to the western extremity of the Kuen-Lun, and at last right over the barrier into the once Aryan region of western Turkestan. These Huai Chi conquered the slightly Hellenized kingdom of Bactria and mixed with Aryan people there. Later on, these Huai Chi became or were merged with Aryan elements into a people called the Indo-Scythians, who went on down the Khyber Pass and conquered northern portions of India as far as Benares in 100 and 150 AD, wiping out the last vestiges of Hellenic rule in India. This big splashover of the Mongolian races westward was probably not the first of such splashes, but it's the first recorded splash. In the rear of the Huai Chi were the Huns, and in the rear of the Huns, and turning them now northward, was the vigorous Han dynasty of China. In the reign of the greatest of the Han monarchs, Wu Ti, 140 to 86 BC, the Huns had been driven northward out of the whole of eastern Turkestan, or subjugated. The Tarim Basin swarmed with Chinese settlers, and caravans were going over westward with silk and lacquer and jade to trade for the gold and silver of Armenia and Rome. The splashover of the Huai Chi is recorded, but it's fairly evident that much westward movement of sections of the Hunnish peoples is not recorded. From 200 BC to 200 AD, the Chinese Empire maintained a hard, resolute, advancing front towards nomadism, and the surplus of the nomads drifted steadily west. There was no such settling down behind a final frontier on the part of the Chinese as we see in the case of the Romans at the Rhine and Danube. The drift of the nomads before this Chinese thrust, century by century, turned southward at first towards Bactria. The Parthians of the 1st century B.C. probably mingled Scythian and Mongolian elements. The singing arrows that destroyed the army of Crassus came, it would seem, originally from the Altai and the Tian Shan. After the 1st century B.C., the line of greater attraction and least resistance lay for a time towards the north of the Caspian. In a century or so, all the country known as Western Turkestan was Mongolized, and so it remains to this day. A second great thrust by China began about 75 A.D. and accelerated the westward drift of the nomads. In 102, Pan Shao, a Chinese general, was sending explorers from his advanced camp upon the Caspian, or as some authorities say, the Persian Gulf, to learn particulars of the Roman power, but their reports decided him not to proceed. By the 1st century AD, nomadic Mongolian peoples were in evidence upon the eastern boundaries of Europe, already greatly mixed with Nordic nomads, and with uprooted Nordic elements from the Caspian Pamir region. There were Hunnish peoples established between the Caspian Sea and the Urals. West of them were the Alans, probably also a Mongolian people with Nordic elements. They'd fought against Pompey the Great when he was in Armenia in 65 BC. These were as yet the furthest westward peoples of the new Mongolian advance, and they made no further westward push until the 4th century AD. To the northwest, the Finns, a Mongolian people, had long been established as far west as the Baltic. West of the Huns, beyond the Don, there were purely Nordic tribes, the Goths. These Goths had spread southeastward from their region of origin in Scandinavia. They were a Teutonic people, and we've already marked them crossing the Baltic in the map we have given of the earlier distribution of the Aryan-speaking people. These Goths continued to move southeastward across Russia, using the rivers and never forgetting their Baltic watercraft. No doubt they assimilated much Scythian population as they spread down to the Black Sea. In the 1st century AD, They were in two main divisions, the Ostrogoths, the East Goths, who were between the Don and the Dnieper, and the Visigoths, or West Goths, west of the Dnieper. During the first century, there was quiescence over the great plains, but population was accumulating and the tribes were fermenting. The second and third centuries seem to have been a phase of comparatively moist seasons and abundant grass. Presently, in the fourth and fifth centuries, the weather grew drier, and the grass became scanty, and the nomads stirred afresh. But it's interesting to note that in the opening century of the Christian era, the Chinese Empire was strong enough to expel and push off from itself the surplus of this Mongolian nomadism to the north of it, which presently conquered North India and gathered force and mingled with Aryan nomadism, and fell at last, like an avalanche, upon the weak-backed Roman Empire. Before we go on to tell of the blows that now began to fall upon the Roman Empire and of the efforts of one or two great men to arrest the collapse, we may say a few words about the habits and quality of these westward-drifting, barbaric, Mongolian peoples who were now spreading from the limits of China towards the Black and Baltic seas. It's still the European custom to follow the lead of the Roman writers and write of these Huns and their associates as of something incredibly destructive and cruel. But such accounts as we have from the Romans were written in periods of panic, and the Roman could lie about his enemies with the freedom and vigour that must arouse the envy even of the modern propagandist. He could talk of Punic faith as a byword for perfidy while committing the most abominable treacheries against Carthage, and his railing accusations of systematic cruelty against this people or that were usually the prelude and excuse for some frightful massacre or enslavement or robbery on his own part. He had quite a modern passion for self-justification. We must remember that these accounts of the savagery and frightfulness of the Huns came from a people whose chief amusement was gladiatorial shows, and whose chief method of dealing with insurrection and sedition was nailing the offender to a cross to die. From first to last, the Roman Empire must have killed hundreds of thousands of men in that way. A large portion of the population of this empire that could complain of the barbarism of its assailants consisted of slaves, subject practically to almost any lust or caprice at the hands of their owners. It's well to bear these facts in mind before we mourn the swamping of the Roman Empire by the barbarians as though it was an extinction of all that's fine in life by all that's black and ugly. The facts seem to be that the Hunnish people were the eastern equivalent of the primitive Aryans, and that in spite of their profound racial and linguistic differences, they mixed with the nomadic and semi-nomadic residuum of the Aryan-speaking races north of the Danube and Persia very easily and successfully. Instead of killing, they enlisted and intermarried with the peoples they invaded. They had that necessary gift for all peoples destined to political predominance, tolerant assimilation. They came rather late in time, and their nomadic life was more highly developed than that of the primitive Aryans. The primitive Aryans were a forest and ox wagon people who took to the horse later. The Hunnish peoples had grown up with the horse. Some when about 1200 or 1000 years BC they began to ride the horse. The bit, the saddle, the stirrup, these are not primitive things, but they're necessary if man and horse are to keep going for long stretches. It's well to bear in mind how modern a thing is riding. Altogether, man hasn't been in the saddle for much more than 3,000 years. We've already noted the gradual appearance of the war chariot, the mounted man, and finally of disciplined cavalry in this history. It was from the Mongolian regions of Asia that these things came. To this day, men in Central Asia go rather in the saddle than on their proper feet. Says Ratzel, strong, long-necked horses are found in enormous numbers on the steppes. For Mongols and Turkomans, riding isn't a luxury. Even the Mongol shepherds tend their flocks on horseback. Children are taught to ride in early youth, and the boy of 3 years old often takes his first riding lesson on a safe child's saddle and makes quick progress.